Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. I apologize for the delay. It is 2:05 p.m. on Saturday, May 14th. We are in receipt of House Bill number 247 as amended on the House floor. It's version A. Does everyone have that document in your files? With me at the table, I'm co-chairman Anna McKinnon. Joining us this afternoon, Senator Hoffman, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Chair, good afternoon.
Vice Chairman Michicki.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator John Levy.
Good afternoon.
And we may be joined shortly by Co-Chairman Kelly, who is on other state business at this time. If I could invite Director Alper and Commissioner Hoffbeck. If you recall, yesterday in Senate Finance, we rolled through a variety of versions. We have had public testimony on the Senate version that came to us from resources. We now have a product from the House for consideration. Mr. Alper.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Hoffbeck, any opening comments?
Yes, Madam Chair, just very briefly, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. After the House passed the bill last night, we had an opportunity to brief the governor on the components within the bill. After briefing the governor felt like it generally met the although very different from the bill he originally proposed, generally met the requirements of what he was seeking to accomplish with this bill, and stands in support of the bill that was passed out of the House yesterday. And with that, I will turn it over to Director Alper.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. To clarify one thing you just said a moment ago, the version before this committee is version C.A, or C amended on the House floor. C was what came out of the House Rules Committee. And the format I'm going to use today is very similar to what I did yesterday, going through the basic provisions of the bill, the difference being, of course, this is, in fact, a very different bill than we talked about yesterday. It was heavily, substantially amended on the floor of the House, rewritten. The version that it was turned into was based in large measure on what came out of the House Finance Committee a little over a month ago, with additional and substantial parts. But the basic structure and syntax comes from the House Finance Committee substitute. In the document before you, and I believe your members have the color version or what's projected on the screen, where there is a substantial change from yesterday, I've used the purple italics just to point out that it's different from what I previously talked about, and then that little four-star bullet rather than the single dot bullet to indicate what, at least in our judgment, was a major change in the bill from day to day. So if I may, going through the basic sections of the bill, talking about exploration credits, the governor's bill was for the most part neutral on them. They were allowing them to sunset as they're currently scheduled to sunset, maintaining the previously extended Middle Earth extension for the exploration credits in the non-Cook Inlet, non-North Slope areas, and repealing the dormant older DNR credits. The only real change made in this version is that the Frontier Basin extension was reworded a little bit for this is the specific change made for OTNA, who lost their access to their rig. They have a full year of extension to take care of that rather than the 6 months that was in the Rules Committee version of the bill, a relatively minor change of no substantial dollar impact. Moving on to slide number 4, the Cook Inlet and Myrtle Earth credits. See, there is a lot more purple ink on this one. The House bill maintained the 25% NOL for 1 year for 2017, and only if producing by the end of 2016. That is the same as what came out of rules. The NOL for Cook Inlet goes to 0% in 2018. There's not going to be a lost credit after the end of 2017. There is an error in the document here. The QCE is actually repealed on July 1st of 2016, or effectively an immediate effective date. That's language from the governor's original bill. So that's been sped up, that the 20% QCE is going away. And the maker of that amendment, Representative Seaton, described that as something that was acceptable to the major producers. The primary users of that, the developers in Cook Inlet, because the work that they're doing in the short term is qualifying primarily for the well lease expenditure credit. The WLE is reduced to 20% from 40% in 2017, repealed in 2018. Basically, you've got a ramp down towards zero of all of the major Cook Inlet credits. This is in some ways similar to the Senate Resources Committee substitute of the companion bill. The main difference is whereas that bill eliminated all of the Cook Inlet taxes, this keeps them in place and, in fact, accelerates the sunset. So the Cook Inlet tax caps, which in current law are supposed to go away in 2022, are now, in the current bill, going to be going away in 2019. Those are a fairly large tax. It's a 35% net profits tax that would kick in without any offsets, any per barrel credits. The expectation is that will not happen, meaning that the working group that's put in place by this bill will meet and propose legislation, and there will be a new Cook Inlet tax regime that takes effect sometime in the next 2 or 3 years before January 1st, 2019. But it puts a bit of a hammer on that, saying that if it doesn't occur, the tax system that kicks in is a somewhat onerous tax in Cook Inlet. Meanwhile, the Middle Earth system is kept at something of a hybrid. The 25% NOL is maintained into the future, but only if there is a plan of development, meaning that there's some filter saying that the state has to authorize the work before it goes forward and can earn NOLs in the Middle Earth area. And then there's a 10% capital expenditure or QCE credit maintained in Middle Earth. Moving on to slide 5, that's the North Slope credit, also the limits and carry forwards. Probably the most significant changes are on this slide. The big change that was made is that the House passed a bill that said there are, for companies who produce more than 15,000 barrels a day, there are no carried forward operating losses. So if they are not profitable, then those losses are simply absorbed by the company. They're not able to be used in a future year. That is changed for the companies who produce less than 15,000 barrels a day. They can continue to earn operating loss credits that can be cashed out at up to $70 million per year. That's in many ways similar to the structure in the Rules Committee substitute, although in the Rules bill, that went away for only after 3 years, in which case those smaller companies would be forced to, in that case, carry their lease expenditures forward. The large companies in the Rules bill were able to carry their lease expenditures forward. In this case, those are simply gone. Another filter here, to qualify for the operating loss credit, it must be on a lease from which the state receives a royalty. There was some concern stated by the maker of the amendment that and other members as well, if we're going to be paying out more in credits than we receive in production tax, well, at least we get the royalty, we get other major revenue measures. But if the production in question occurs on land that the state doesn't get the royalty, that's not true, and we could, in fact, be negative. This puts an additional filter to say the state must get a royalty or at least a shared federal royalty. NPRA would qualify because we have a relationship with the federal government that says we get half of their royalty, therefore losses from NPRA, say, would be qualified for the NOL under this plan. The other change is that the NOL itself, for those companies eligible to receive it, these are, again, the small companies and the developers, is ramping down. The 35% rate reverts to 32 next year and then steps down by three percentage points every 2 years until finally bottoming down at 25% NOL in the year 2023. That 25% rate is a number that's been kicked around in different amendments and different concepts, and it reflects the original operating loss rate in the introduced version of Senate Bill 21 from the beginning of the 2013 session. Madam Chair, if there aren't questions on this, I'll move on. But this is certainly the most substantial changes to the bill are on the slide before us, number 5. Moving to slide number 6, this is the minimum tax changes, the floor, so to speak. The governor's bill increased it to 5% and then hardened it against all credits so that the true floor would be paid by all producers regardless of profitability, regardless of size or circumstance. The House bill does add a fairly narrow 5% floor, meaning it only kicks in if the yearly price of oil is greater than $70 a barrel. The current floor isn't really 4%, Madam Chair. It's a stair step. It's 4% at prices above 25. It steps down to 3% between 20 and 25, 2% 17, 50 to 20, and so forth. The 5% floor becomes one more step, so that the 4% would be 25 to 70, the 5% 70 and above, and really it only lasts till about $80 a barrel. Once you get above $80 a barrel, the floor falls away and the 35% net tax would kick in. So in that $70 to $80 range, you would see the 5% floor in the current version of the bill. It does not harden the floor against any additional credits, so the new oil, the GVR credits, the small producer credit, for as long as they last, can still be used to go below the floor. But because there are not going to be operating loss credits carried forward, there's an indirect hardening of the floor, because with the absence of those credits, you can't use NOL credits to go against the floor. The exception to that, of course, is there are the currently existing operating loss credits from prior to the effective date of the bill. Basically, companies' 2016 losses, should they have any, would be usable in future years to go below the minimum tax.
Mr. Alpert, in a following presentation that you provide us, can you give us an example of, I know we've seen it either from the department or from Analytica, that gave us a high-low scenario of piercing the floor. What we'd like is a list of everything that pierces the floor and at what point for a smaller company that might operate in each of the regions, the North Slope Basin or the Cook Inlet Basin, so that we can see how those operate and affect those differently. I believe those have been presented before, so that's not new information that's being requested.
Yes, Madam Chair, we're happy to do that. And you would like that for current law as well as the bill before the committee?
Yes, but on a separate page, if you would. Try not to blend those two options together. Just
we'll do,
to us
we'll
as
do.
Clear as you can. Senator Bishop.
On that request, I'd like to know how many producers are below 15,000 and how many are above 15,000. Thank you.
Bishop, we will do that. If I can, Madam Chair, I'm going to move on to slide number 7. This is the new oil or the gross value reduction provisions. This was not something that was in the governor's original proposal, but there's been the idea of graduation or sunset of new oil in different versions of the bill. The primary change made in the amendment was to go back to the 7% number that was in the House Finance version as amended on the House floor in April. A new provision was added to say, in addition to that, if the price of oil stays north of $70 a barrel for 3 years out of that 7-year period, there's a what could be called an early graduation provision. The GVR would fall away with the expectation that if those companies were more profitable than expected during 3 out of the 7 years, then they no longer need the benefit of the gross value reduction. And in that case, the production would revert to legacy oil and all of the other statutory provisions that go along with that, the sliding scale instead of the 5-barrel credit, the stronger floor, that sort of thing.
Mr. Alper, I have a question on this slide. Could you provide the committee a scenario that outlines Point Thompson's effect of the $5 credit and how that affects the floor?
Certainly, Madam Chair, and to off the top of my head, I could say that the $5 a barrel credit for new oil can be used below the floor to go to zero under current law. The question here is, at what point would that production fall away from that and revert to the legacy? So you would like a little bit of modeling effect, this is going to change Point Thompson's tax treatment into the future.
I'd like to know how it currently exists in state statute, so that we understand the model of Point Thompson. It's been quite some time that we've been trying to bring that online for the people of Alaska. So I'd like to know what it looks like today and then compare that with what's being proposed before us.
Thank you. We will do that. Slide number 8 is some new information, new provisions that were not in the current version at all. So this whole slide is purple. The issue of the migrating credits, although the language in the bill might have inartfully done it and we're not certain if it's going to work, the intent, as was explained to us, is to bring back a provision from the governor's original version of the bill. This is the circumstance where there's a year with a lot of volatility and certain months within that year are taxed at the full net profits tax rate in certain months are below at the minimum tax rate. What happens in the minimum tax months is that some fraction of the per barrel credits are lost or foregone by the company, because you can't use the whole $8 before they get, in essence, cut off by the minimum tax payment. Those unused credits from those low price months under current law can be used to offset the taxes from other months, because it's an annual tax and because the minimum tax, strictly speaking, is an annual calculation, not a monthly calculation. This change, as originally proposed by the governor, was to make the minimum tax more of a monthly calculation and say that the per barrel credits, if not usable in one month, can't migrate to another month. You might recall some modeling slides from an earlier presentation we did looking at the year 2014 as the poster child for this circumstance. In 2014, the price of oil started high. It was very low by December. And because of this existing law at true-up, we ended up paying about $110 million in refunds to the major producers because of what we call the migrating credit issue. The committee substitute from the House intends to put in our migrating credit fix, so that the per barrel credits are tied to their month and can't move within the year. A second change, and this is very new language, although there was a similar bill that passed the other body 6 or 8 years ago. If there's a funding limitation and less money to purchase credits than is needed, there are credits to be purchased. This authorizes the ARM board, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, to purchase credits from companies at a discount at 60 cents on the dollar, and then provide some language mandating that the state repurchase them from the ARM board at full face value within 5 years. That gives the ARM board about an 8% return on investment if they got it 5 years later, and it kills two birds with one stone, in effect, by helping them meet their unfunded liabilities into the future.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the migrating credits, with the understanding that we already are behind in audits, what impact will this change require in additional audit time? And how much would, if any?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. It's an issue that will only be relevant in a year under SB 21 where there is months above the minimum tax and months below the minimum tax. 2014 is the only year historically where that will come in. It will probably require a little bit of additional scrutiny on 2014, but for the fact that this isn't a retroactive provision. So this isn't going to change anything that actually happened in 2014. It would only be relevant if in a future year we had a lot of price volatility.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Just wondering why this presentation doesn't include the gross value at the point of production. Did something change in this bill? The definition's not included.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, thank you. Yeah, that was a change, and it was missed. I put this presentation together in a couple of hours late yesterday after the House passed the bill. That should be in there. There's another provision from the governor's original bill that says that the gross value at the point of production can't be below zero. That was added in the amendment that became the final version of this bill to pass the House. What we're talking about here is for a specific field, if you have a very high tariff and a very low price, there are cases where the gross value could go to below zero. That would then be offsetting the positive values from a company's other production for the purpose of calculating, well, gross value, which is a step along the path to calculate net profits, production tax value, and tax. So, and the example we gave when we earlier presented to the committee was Point Thompson. Again, Point Thompson has a very high tariff because of the low volume and very expensive new pipeline. The estimated cost of getting Point Thompson oil to market today is about $31-$32 a barrel. So should the price of oil go below that, that would have a negative wellhead or value or a negative GVPP. Using that example of a 5,000 barrel a day, a dollar or two of negative value, that's a couple of million dollars of negative value that would be able to offset the working interest partners' other assets, and that, per the provision in this bill, would reset to zero, so they would not gain that $2 million negative value. And I apologize for not having that in the presentation. That was just one that we missed on the fly.
Any other questions? Did you want to continue, Mr. Elper, on the ARM board alternative, or were you through that?
Sure. The Arm Board was, as I said, there was a bill that passed the House, the other body, about, I think it was 8 years ago, I think it was in the 25th legislature, empowering that. Back at that moment in time, it was before ACES took effect, and ACES had the fund, and it eliminated the caps on repurchases. In the PPT era, there was a little bit more concern that the state might have credits out there that weren't being repurchased, so the Arm Board was seen as a backdoor to get money to these companies. Now we have a new concept where there might be not enough money, there might be not enough appropriation given the credit demand. So this is an alternative mechanism to get liquidity to the companies, although the statutory language says we would only be buying those credits at 60% of face value.
Mr. Alper, well, I really want to solve the pension deficit problem. This seems like an option that may not have been thought about for very long. And so do we know whether the Arm Board has been consulted about repurchasing credits? Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Madam Chair, for the record, Commissioner Hoffbeck. We didn't have an Arm Board meeting in order to, when this was brought to us and asked whether it was a viable investment for the Arm Board. But I did sit down with CIO Gary Bader, and because this is just authorizes the Arm Board to make these purchases, it doesn't mandate it. He looked at it, he said it would be an investment that the Arm Board would certainly see as a viable investment if it were available. But it has not gone before the entire board. It was just the CIO looking at it, saying it would be something that they would certainly consider. And since it doesn't require the Arm Board to do it, it was something that was seen as no harm.
So here comes the line of questioning, Commissioner. So is there a gate on how much, has there been anticipated a gate on how much the Arm Board could put out at a 60% buyback that the state would be required to pay at 100%?
It would all have to fall within the Arm Board's investment criteria on prudent investor criteria, and certainly the Arm Board would have limits on what it would establish limits on what it would be willing to purchase. Again, that would be something that the board would have to decide.
Commissioner, has the administration contemplated what the draw would be from the general fund if a large portion of tax credits purchased at 60% were demanded at one particular time from the state?
Madam Chair, the draw from the Arm Board investments?
If there is $770-some million out available and we've limited the access to DNR, DOR at 100%, say $25 million per company as requested by the governor, what is the liability to hit the books in 1 year should the Arm Board, in seeking a cash infusion, try to ask the state of Alaska for 100% of? What's our liability? Because it's not in our hands anymore. We're letting an outside third party, we're guaranteeing an outside third party inside the state an 8% rate of return on a variable amount of money.
Madam Chair, the Arm Board would consult with the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue would look at what the ability of the state to repay would be before they would recommend or advise the Arm Board that the money would likely be available for repayment, and it would be structured in a fashion that that would fit within the what would be anticipated as the amount that the state would be capable of repaying within a 5-year period of time. The only time limit on here is that after the Arm Board purchases it, there's up to 5 years for the state to authorize the Department of Revenue to buy these particular credits. Of course, those credits were a liability to the state already. They were going to have to be purchased at some point in time, whether from the Arm Board or from the producer.
I'm not sure if I could add just a little bit more to that. Ken Alper here. The Arm Board language is in two different places in the bill. Section 1 is in the Arm Board statutes themselves, simply authorizing this. The repurchase language is in Section 28, sub R, on page 36 of the bill. Now, although it says we shall within 5 years repurchase, all repurchases are subject to appropriation, of course. So the legislature has to authorize that spending. It's not like anything happens automatically. That what's specifically waived here in R is that the so-called cap, the $70 million per company per year cap that's in the bill for producers, does not apply to the onboard repurchases.
Any other questions from committee members? Please continue.
Thank you. That's it for the new provisions, and now we're back to what were the so-called technical provisions. Most of these are unchanged. The GVR not being able to be used to increase the size of an operating loss credit, as is. The municipal utility expenditure, what we call the proration of lease expenditures provision, unchanged. The same degree of transparency language is in the bill as was yesterday. We could release the name and the amount of credits, cashable credits received, but not information about the work done with the credits. That remains in the bill going forward. There is a minor change to the interest rate because, as I said earlier, the House Finance Committee was used as the base bill. The Rules Committee bill went to compound interest and raised the rate to 5% over Fed. This uses the House finance structure, which is 5% over Fed, but just for the first 4 years. And then the compounding goes back to simple interest after 4 years. This was put in there, as I understand it, in reaction to concern over our own staff, the tax division, taking too long to audit taxes and the amount of interest that could accrue through compounding if we were to raise the rates too much.
Mr. Alper, I have a question on that. Is there clarity in the statute or in the bill as to when the department would implement these tax increases? So are we going back in time on some of this? Is this forward thinking that any new taxpayer submission of a tax in January 1st, 2017, that the cycle of audit, and depending how long the department takes to audit, this is prospective, or does it go retroactive, and someone that's in the queue right now that is being audited for, let's say, 2012, 2015 taxes, does it go back, and then the longer the department itself takes, is the interest rate then retroactive?
No, Madam Chair, the interest rate is tied to the time that we're in. So if to use the example, right now we're auditing 2010 and 11 production tax returns. 2011 tax returns were due in April 1st, 2012. So through 2012 and 13, the 11% statutory rate did apply. And when we do finally send the bill, the any assessments on those, there'll be 2 years of 11% interest. Then there'll be 3 years of 3% interest. That's the SB 21 interest rate that took effect January 1st, 2014. This new interest rate with compounding will kick in January 1st, 2017.
So it goes back retroactive?
Madam Chair, no. Just on the time period that the taxes were delinquent after January 1st, 2017, is this new higher interest rate effective?
For a tax return that was submitted in 2012?
Yes. So the 2012 tax return will have, just as the, in effect, the 3%, the drop from 11 to 3 was retroactive well by those terms, meaning there are tax returns out there that have two different levels of interest on them because the tax has been delinquent through periods in which our statutory tax interest rate was at different levels. But the interest is based on the time, not on the origin of the tax return itself.
It's a consideration.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last one of these technical slides. There was also a minor change, or actually a little bit more moderate change, to the Alaska Hire prioritization language. The previous version of the bill, which is the same as what came from the Senate Resources Committee to this committee last month, was to say if you're at 80% or greater Alaska Hire, you get prioritization given limited funds when we're spending out of the tax credit repurchase fund. This was instead changed to a true rank order. where we would get the Alaska higher percentages and we would pay those with the highest number of Alaskan residents as a percentage first and the ones with the lowest last within a given year's, of course, worth of credits. We would 1 year would always come before the next year. The other change is that we've broadened the definition to include employees of the contractors, not just the direct recipient of the credit. The last two changes are that first off, we have this provision that says if the company owes money to the state for a royalty or another non-tax obligation, we can withhold credit for that. There was some debate over can we then use the credit to pay the obligation on the taxpayer's behalf, and we sought that. The previous version of the bill said, well, no, we need, if they're contesting it, we should get their authorization, their permission, before we use that credit to pay the royalty or other obligation. That permission language was taken out of this version of the bill. They can, it's still limited to just the oil and gas business. We can't pay someone's, you know, I use the example, if a major oil producer happens to also be in the tobacco business, we can't pay their cigarette taxes, but we can pay their oil and gas royalties on their behalf if they are delinquent in some way and we're holding back a credit from them.
Senator Bishop, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Let's go back to Alaska Higher. So you're not tying it to a percentage in black and white. You're just going to... So I'm gonna give my example and see if I'm right or wrong. So now you don't have a percentage tied to that. So let's say company X comes in at 51% Alaska Higher, and they're the highest one in the queue. That's how you're going to pay them based on, there's no index here. It's not indexed. So am I right in my thinking? How are you getting there?
Senator Bishop, the language in question is Section 35, G2 on page 41 of the bill now, and it says the department must grant a preference between two applicants to the applicant with a higher percentage of resident workers in the applicant's workforce, including workers employed by the applicant's direct contractors in the state in the previous calendar year.
The high percentage could be 51%, and he gets paid first. Is that right?
If that were the highest one, through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes. And finally,
Mr. Alper, I have a question on that. When you've included contractors with larger corporations, how are you going to calculate that? And how do you calculate corporations that are going to be bigger? You're just counting their Alaska base, or if they're from London or some other country, are you counting Alaska versus all of the folks that they hire around the world?
Madam Chairman, whether we're looking at just the company or the company's contractors, it would be the work related to their Alaskan operations, their projects in Alaska. Are the people doing that work Alaska resident or not? This is one of those provisions that's going to have a fairly robust regulatory process attached to it. We're going to have to flesh out the details of how we interface with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and we get their statistics and we get the information on where their workforce resides so that we can make these sorts of determinations.
How does that apply to fishing?
Madam Chair, I don't understand the question. I'm sorry.
How would we apply resident work status to fishing?
Honestly, I don't understand the question enough to give a meaningful answer. I'm sorry.
Well, we bring in hundreds of workers from other areas for fishing. We hire contractors, processors. They receive credits. Alaskan projects have contractors. They come in from other areas. If we don't have the skills, I'm trying to see how the Labor Department quantifies Alaska Higher for fishing.
Madam Chair, I don't know precisely how they do, but I do know that they publish analysis by business sector within the state, by industry, what percentage Alaska Higher they have. I've even seen analysis within the oil and gas sector by trade, where you learn that X percentage of the laborers versus X percentage of the operating engineers are Alaska resident versus not. So I know the data is out there. I don't consider myself expert in how exactly it's parsed out.
Thank you. If I could ask my staff, maybe we can have the Department of Labor come before us and explain how they quantify their numbers. I know we have a former commissioner at the table that might be able to offer us some information on that. Please, Senator Bishop.
First thing, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kramer, I'd ask the ESD division director or a research and analysis to come request at the chairman's request first, but as a former commissioner. For fishing, you know, typically the non-resident hire rate in the fishing industry has hovered around 70% to 77%. Be that as it may, we just like all Alaska hire residency requirements, we use the permanent fund requirement for determining residency in the state of Alaska. So there you go.
Permanent fund.
Qualification for the permanent fund dividend is the most meaningful definition of are you an Alaskan, I suppose, Madam Chair. The last technical provision has to do with the surety bond. That's unchanged. This was originally added in the first committee in the House, the Resources Committee, a $250,000 bond, and that bond is attachable by people unpaid in event of a bankruptcy or a circumstance. And the situations that precipitated this idea came from a couple of bankruptcies in the Kenai and some local vendors, specifically in Homer, that were left without any recourse when a couple of companies went belly up. The last slide here, and I apologize for the small numbers, it's probably easier to read with the document on your desks, is the fiscal side-by-side. This bill is, as far as the dollar value, is somewhat higher than the Rules Committee substitute, and you can see where it breaks down. There's a little bit more money from the floor hardening. There's also some money that starts to come in because of the early sunset of the Cook Inlet tax caps, and then the reduced spending because of the reduction in the Cook Inlet credits, as well as the limitation of who's able to get North Slope credits. But the most important number here isn't in the revenue or the expenditure side, but in the NOL carry forward line. That's the last line on the document. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday when I was before this committee. Because losses for major producers or large producers over 15,000 will no longer be carried forward by 2021, the number actually goes down to zero. And in 2020, there's only $69 million in carried forward credits or the equivalent. If you compare, say, the governor's original bill to the version here for the 4 years on the table, FY17 through 20, the current bill, the bill before the committee, brings in about $1 billion less in revenue or expenditure savings than the governor's original bill, but there's about $1.1 billion less in future obligation through carried forward losses. So in effect, this is at the bottom line, a stronger bill than the governor's original proposal.
Mr. Halper, that's one word to describe it. Could you do a run for us on the effects of this bill to production? So we do a spring forecast, we do a fall forecast. Can we look and see what that does to production, and can you get that to us by Monday?
Madam Chair, are you looking for us to forecast possible changes in production based on reaction to the provisions of the bill? I'm not quite sure.
Absolutely. We would like to know what we lose by taking this step.
Madam Chair, I'll be honest with you. I don't know that we can forecast that, and I don't know that we can forecast it by Monday, especially because the staff that does that sort of work is, I would have to bring them in on Sunday, but I will talk with the commissioner afterwards. We'll try to figure out what we could do. We'll certainly do our best.
Mr. Alper, when you do a forecast for us, you use Alaska State statute and you bring your team in. So I expect that you can give us the numbers specific to this to tell Alaskans how much production we lose. Senator Kelly.
The question I had was, you said you couldn't do it by Monday. I get that. But you don't think you have the capacity to do it or the ability to do it? Do we not have that information?
Mr. Co-Chair, our production forecasts come from information primarily what's reported to us by the producers themselves. They tell us what work they're going to do. I imagine we would need to go through some sort of outreach to say what less work might you be doing if this bill were to take effect. Otherwise, we'd be frankly guessing a little bit.
Senator Kelly, follow up.
Well, I mean, economists generally do this kind of work. I mean, certainly the production numbers, the actual production numbers would be best. But it, ultimately, do you think, is that what you'll rely on is an economic model, or will we ever, do you think you will be able to get in time the information from the producers?
Mr. Co-Chair, I would like to defer my answer for a day or so and talk to my staff Monday morning, and we'll figure out how we're going to do it, but we will certainly do our best to get an answer.
Other questions from committee members? Is there any possibility, Senator Bishop, is there any way that we can quantify job loss based on this scenario?
Well, you know, can we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease? we're back on the record. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think you asked me what would the job losses or potential downfall. Restate your question again for the record, please.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. I was wondering if there was a place inside of Department of Labor that we could go that could quantify any type of job loss. I know that we're projecting, just because of the $4 billion deficit in cash flow for the state, and then a decline in the budget that is being proposed, that we're going to see job loss from a variety of ways. But specific to this bill, I'm wondering if there's any kind of economics that's run at the Department of Labor to give us any insight. Of course, we could hear from industry, and that's what you and I were talking about offline. It's just I'm wondering whether the people of Alaska will have confidence in those numbers.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I've said it once, many, numerous times here, I can put Dan Robinson, the director, right on the spot down at the Department of Labor Research and Analysis. That's a great department. They run good data. It could take them a while to produce it, and that's the best place to go to get the answer to your question, research and analysis.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Machicki, followed by Co-Chairman Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're asking questions that are essentially impossible to quantify. You're talking about an industry that went from $107 a barrel down into the 30s, now hovering just above the 40s, and they have significant reductions in loss and project work. There's going to be production loss. There's going to be job loss. Asking them to stack that on top of it would take hundreds of thousands of dollars and months to quantify accurately. An easier way to ask this question: do you think this will result, without a number, in greater or less production? Do you believe it will result, without a number, in additional jobs or less jobs? And what other levers should we be evaluating as a state in its general effect?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, it's sometimes I feel like every time I say something, I see it on Twitter, so I'm going to try to be careful. Any transfer of wealth between the sovereign and the lessee and the producers is going to change decision-making. Now, the choices we make in changing oil and gas taxes is the marginal benefit better than the marginal cost, right? So, to a certain extent, any of this is likely to reduce someone's decision to do some activity. I don't have a definite sense for how much companies rely on, and really we're talking about the specific idea of being able to carry forward losses in one year into a future year for production tax purposes. That is certainly the most dramatic change made by this bill as it was amended yesterday, and in some ways the most controversial change. The commissioner spoke yesterday about this being a severance tax. It's not an income tax. It's an unfair comparison to say other countries don't do this, because other countries are countries and they tend to have one tax, and an oil and gas producer in Alaska has five, more or less, four of ours, plus the federal corporate income tax. And both income taxes do fully allow losses to carry forward and be recaptured. So what this is something of a hybrid tax. It's a gross tax at the low end, tied to net profits at the high end, and this now adds a new wrinkle to say, oh, and under no circumstances can it go below zero. I don't know how it's going to impact, to what degree it's going to impact behavior. I'm sure it's going to impact behavior to some degree.
Senator Bishop.
Positive or negative?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, more money or less, if it's less money or less certainty on the point of industry, I imagine it would have to be negative to some degree.
Senator Machicki.
So I think a fair answer is inevitably some job loss, inevitably some negative production effect, and that's fine. I'm saying that's fine. It's just a given. I think the part you didn't answer about my question is the philosophy of the administration on that balance, right? And we've got revenue that comes to the general fund, and then we have a whole bunch of jobs out there that puts food on the tables of Alaskans, have a lot of other effect. They pay property taxes locally for services that the state's going to be less and less able to support. Philosophically, what do you think the sort of 30,000-foot effect is, and how should we be analyzing this to make sure we minimize the effect on everyone in the state as opposed to just the general fund?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, for the record, Randy Hoftak, Commissioner of Revenue. Everything that we do to close a $4 billion gap is going to have those type of effects. I mean, it is going to impact money in the system. When there's going to be, you know, job cuts in whatever sector we go to try and where we pull back on state support, whether it be the oil industry or nonprofits or the university or wherever we may make the cuts, you know, those have that's essentially that same ripple effect through every one of those industries. So, and we can only support for so long by using our savings. And so as I said yesterday, this isn't something we went into because we had some desire to upset the apple cart, but really that we had a fiscal situation where we had to make some changes. And so the oil and gas industry is being impacted substantially from some of the changes that we're making. But speaking with the sponsor of the amendment, I talked to him this morning about some of the Cook Inlet changes in the transition periods, and he felt like those were the type of changes that were necessary for several of that those were acceptable changes for a couple of companies that were working to finish up a couple of projects. That's why some of that transition period was there, that it got them to a point where we wouldn't cut the legs out from under them with some of these changes. So I think, you know, there was an attempt by the sponsor of the amendment to try and accommodate as many of the industry concerns as he possibly could. Certainly industry has to speak for themselves on that, but and then the comment that I've heard in testimony, and I think that we've made also, is that the producers have made it very clear that they won't operate for long periods of time at a loss. I mean, that's not their business model. And so they're going to pull back when they're losing money to whatever extent necessary so that they're not losing money. Of course, our biggest impact that we've had on the producers is the change in the net operating loss and the carry forward on that. And some of that would be resolved by the producer's own actions to pull back and to not operate at a loss. And so it will have some impact, but some of it would be corrected by industry's own actions regardless of the tax system. But anytime we take money out of the system, it's going to have impacts. There's no way to get away from that.
Senator Kelly, followed by Senator Bishop.
A few weeks ago, we had Janik here, and I asked him the question. I said, if all of this talk about oil taxes, and if you were on a game show, I'm not asking you guys, but I'm not going to pick on you because this isn't your bill. I mean, you're endorsing it. I don't know why, but I'm not going to put you guys on the spot here. But anyway, so we asked Janik, remember, and I said, you know, Janik, you're on a game show, and you have to push a button. You have 3 seconds to do it. Is anything we're going to do going to increase production or have it neutral or make it negative? And he hemmed and hawed, and he lost. But he could have won $1 million because it's gonna reduce production. And thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck, for saying that, because that's just the point here, is we're going to reduce production. We have no business going down a path that's going to reduce production. Now, I am a little concerned that the administration has proposed such sweeping changes without the ability to know what the impact on production is going to be. And I know that's difficult, but I think that's probably something we should have done before we went down this path, because I don't think Alaskans want less production, and the resultant job losses that we'll have that will come from that. We'll also lose contractors. We won't be able to get them back. Rigs will get laid down. That's just the easy part of it. Then they'll get decommissioned and sent elsewhere. And if that happens, they're not coming back. And we will find ourselves in a terrible position with our competitors worldwide. We'll have the Great Rocks, and well, we used to be able to say we were stable, but we're not stable anymore because we change our tax as much as we change our underwear, and it's going to have a huge impact. And we're saying right now we don't have enough money. That's why we're here, is because we don't have enough money. So the changes we're talking about making are going to make it so we have even less money. And we're not losing money right now. We're not getting as much as we could. And that was the philosophy that drove ACES. That's why ACES was such a mess. If you have, if I say I get 10% every dollar you make, if you make a dollar, I get $10. If you make $2, for every, you know the deal, 10%. If you have a dollar and I make 10%, I get 10 cents. You make $2, I get 20, and it just goes up and up and up. But ACES said, no, as you make more money, we get a higher percentage. And then the people who said, well, we can't change ACES, were saying, well, we're going to lose money. No, you're not losing money. It means you could have gotten more, or you're foregoing getting more. And ACES was actually confiscatory. So the problem here isn't that we're losing money. It's that we could in some way get more, or hope that we could not have the reduction that we're getting be less. And the cost is too high. It's at the level of production that the cost really shows itself. And it's going to show itself in jobs. It's going to show itself in absent contractors. And it's going to show itself in infrastructure that leaves the state of Alaska. And when the price comes back, they won't be here for us. We missed the $140 boom because of ACES. And now when oil price is going to come back, we're going to miss this. I hesitate to call whatever's coming a boom. But when the prices stabilize, we'll miss that too, because we were messing around here doing what we always do, which is change oil taxes in this state. It's like a hobby for us. And it's unfortunate, because we've asked this question in the committee a number of times. What will this do to production? And no one's ever had an answer. That should have been an answer that you had before you started down this path. And because I think any impact on production is unacceptable, because if for all the reasons I stated, but certainly because of the job losses.
Thank you, Co-Chairman Kelly. Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
I'll pass. I've said it on the record 3 times, so I don't want to be a broken record.
AKLNG.
Oh, that. I mean, just, okay, now you open the door. Okay, so here you go. Let's go down to Ken, if I could just kind of like have this discussion, Madam Chair. Ken, let's go down to the NOLs, FY 2017. Gov 770, last page.
So, yeah.
Okay, so 247 gov is 773, right? And then 605 for Senate, SB 130, and then the bill that's before us now is 432 in NOLs.
Yes.
Okay. So let's go back just to the gov. So 773, there's $200 million is baked in there from the veto from last year?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no, the carry forward, what we're talking about here are the companies that aren't able to get credit cash because they're the large producers, the majors. This is a new category we added with the spring forecast because we never had it before. But what starts to happen is the majors, because they can't get cash, if they have a loss, they get an NOL credit they have to sit on until the price of oil goes up, and they use it against future taxes. That's that number that we're tracking going from year to year.
So,
Senator Bishop, this is in addition to the 775 of cash flow credits.
Commissioner Hoffbeck, thank you.
Right, and Senator Bishop, through the chair, the baseline number is 618. In other words, If the forecasted price of oil stays what it is at the end of FY17, the majors will be in possession of $618 million worth of uncashable NOLs waiting for the price to go up. If the governor's bill kicked in, that number would go up by about 150 from 618 to 773. That 150, more or less, is the hardening of the floor part. We harden the floor, we make them pay the full minimum tax instead of using carried forward NOLs. That means they're going to be holding on to more NOLs, and that so the number goes up. And that's why the number is going up from year to year as you walk through the timeline here.
So, Madam Chair, if I may, so the 773, okay, so you just, with the forecast, but let's say hypothetically the last 4 months comes in at 60 or above, this number could change again.
Through the Chair, Senator Bishop, it would likely be zero, yes.
Thank you.
Brief at ease. Senate Finance is back on the record. For those in the public and sitting here at the Bill Ray Center in Juneau, what we were trying to figure out is how we were going to do the public hearing on this bill. And so the public hearing will take place tomorrow. We'll notice the meeting for 9 a.m. Because we don't have, we're limited on time. If industry wants to participate, they'll need to sign up tomorrow. And then we'll alternate between folks calling in off net or online or how that goes. So if industry is interested in testifying on the bill before us, if you would contact my staff, that would be helpful so that we can try to have an organized approach to hearing what industry says, trying to give preference to those Alaskans who are calling in. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yesterday's meeting, I think it was yesterday, we talked about the differences on your assumptions for earnings, updates to the revenue resources or sources book. Is that something we can have available tomorrow? I think it would be really helpful for us to have a better understanding of some current numbers.
Through the Chair, Senator Machicki, I actually sent a document along. I don't know if it made it in time to get duplicated for the committee, but it's the one-pager that has the revenue for the next 10 years at all the different prices of oil from like 20 to, no, Madam Chair, it has years in all the columns and then a whole bunch of price points going all the way from like 20 all the way to $130 a barrel with revenue numbers. It looks, it looks like this, I guess. Is that in the packet before the committee or? Yeah, but yes. So this is something, and if it got lost in transit, I'll send it over as soon as I get back to the office.
That was the one I showed them, but they said no. Brief at ease. We're having that document. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Senate Finance. Commissioner, we're having that document copied for the committee now. Is there further questions? We were on slide 11 to the bill before us. Senator Olson?
Chairman, I just want to clear up for tomorrow. It's only invited testimony. Is that correct?
No. We will have
public testimony.
Public testimony. And if the industry contacts us, we'll try to work work them in. We'll start hearing the bill at 9:30.
Okay. I do have a question related to what we've been talking about, Madam Chair. It has to do with the commissioner. There's been a discussion so far that that's what has happened under what has come across to us. There's going to be a decrease in production. As you look at that and try and balance out what's going on with production as opposed to our immediate situation where we've got the $4 billion gap, as you try, we don't have the numbers here, obviously, but as you look at the amount of production that may or may go down by double-digit numbers, what do you think the production like, or what do you think is going to happen to the fiscal gap as you look at, you know, some of these significant changes that are going on with state's financial liability?
Yeah. Through the Chair, Senator Olson, there's a couple of components to that. One, of course, we're going to see reductions in production based on $40 oil.
Sure.
I mean, people are going to lay down rigs. They're not doing some projects. Mm-hmm. I mean, that we really can't do anything to resolve. And I don't, and we could throw an awful lot of credits at that, and I think we wouldn't make a substantial change in what $40 oil is going to do to production. But there's some increment. I don't know that we can measure, but there's some increment that on the margins that'll have some impact the credits. But we do have to balance, you know, how much will we spend to get that incremental production versus the other needs of the state of Alaska. And that's really the dilemma that the governor was facing when he put this plan together, was that, you know, how do you deliver education? How do you deliver health care? How do you deliver public safety in an environment where we don't have very much revenue? And so we had to pull back on some of these things and balance where we spend the money. There's no good solution to a $4 billion problem. And so this was the plan that the governor laid out as the most balanced as far as he was concerned.
Senator Olson?
So in short, what I'm hearing you saying is that at least it appears to be addressing the fiscal situation in spite of the, which has more gravity than the loss of production. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I would say yes. I think if we were to hold industry harmless or keep all credits in place and sacrifice other areas in order to maintain that level of spending, I think it would have a greater decrement on the economy of the state of Alaska.
No further questions, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Commissioner Hopbeck, the governor at the beginning of session provided a suite of options to try to address the budget shortfall. And my concern as the Senate Finance Committee now is in possession of a bill that we can act on. When we're asking you about production, we're really asking you, or I'm asking you that, because the governor's proposed an income tax, which the people of Alaska would pay. And if we have a reduction in production, which is the only thing that, as a state, that we can really affect in a global market, we want to understand the impact, because it seems to me that the administration will then go after more money in the future from Alaskans, because that will be the last place to go. Or we go back, I guess, again on the major revenue stream that the state of Alaska has depended on for years. So I'm not saying that I don't want to review and look at rates of return and investment and weigh those against the choices that we're having to make in other areas of state government. But I don't want to be short-sighted in looking at the long game, and if some of the actions that have taken place in the House actually adversely affect production to the extent that you will be back, or a future administration will be back, asking for Alaskans to pick up that tab difference because we've diverted production opportunities, that's what we're trying to balance, or that's what I'm trying to balance. I'm not trying to put my head in the sand to say that we can afford all of the credits that we are currently providing. We absolutely cannot. Anyone who thinks that we can continue on the same path hasn't looked at all of the balance sheets or the obligations of the state. And we know that throughout Alaska, whether it's a telecom company, whether it's the oil industry, whether it's mining, fishing, or others that have looked at the proposed taxation of their industries, they're all making tough decisions in as we react to this revenue shortfall for the state of Alaska. So they're making choices, and we have to make choices too. I think I've said that some time ago, and it wasn't met well by some and maybe applauded by others, but we know we're all in a tough spot. My issue is, you know, let's not shoot ourselves in the foot in a way, and we hope that you can provide us the necessary information. We do have legislative finance in the room, and so if anyone else has questions at this table for the commissioner or Director Alper, if you'd like to ask those now. Seeing none, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. If I could invite Alexi from Legislative Finance to the microphone, if you could identify yourself for the record. My staff has said that I indicated two different start times for tomorrow's meeting. Is the committee interested in a 9 a.m. start? I'm seeing yeses around the table. Will 9 a.m. work? So 9 a.m., we're going to take public testimony on, it says 2D, CS for House Bill number 247 out of rules as amended, It's 29-GH2609/C.I. For anyone in the public that wants to testify on that, 9 a.m. tomorrow. Alexi, if you could identify yourself for the record, and then please provide us with some comments on the document before us.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. I think the one item that we wanted to comment on is that in the three committees in the House, there's been a fund capitalization fiscal note that has been prepared and then not adopted. So the bill, as you have it, does not deal with the kind of the one of the aspects of this bill, which is how are we paying the credits. Currently in the operating budget paid in both the House and Senate passed, there is the statutory calculation of the payment, which the language indicates is $73.4 million, which is the estimate under the fall forecast. Under the spring forecast, that is more like $30 million. So without additional capitalization of the oil and gas tax credit fund, only $30 million would be available in FY17 to pay those credits. Past committees have prepared fiscal notes that would provide additional funding into that fund. This committee could choose to do so as well, but at this point there is no funding beyond the $30 million roughly available to pay credits.
Thank you for those comments. Are there questions? Mr. Painter, have you had an opportunity to review the percentage interest rate at all in any kind of financial tabulations there?
Madam Chair, the 5%, not in depth, no.
Okay. Do you have any comments on the NOLs as proposed and amended by the version C.A?
Madam Chairman, I do not have any comment about the substance of the bill, just the financial aspect, I suppose.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for staying, Mr. Painter. Any other information the committee needs prior to public testimony tomorrow? Seeing and hearing none, we're adjourned until 9 a.m. May 15th. We're adjourned.